Donald Trump has been called different things by a variety of critics. Ones we could say here on the air include dictator, arrogant, tyrant, king, immoral. My next guest in a recent article in The Atlantic says that those critics are missing the mark and thereby failing to understand how to confront Donald Trump. His Atlantic article is One Word Describes Trump, along with being a contributing writer with The Atlantic. He's a best-selling author. His latest book is Cross Purposes, Christianity's Broken Bargain with Democracy. Additionally, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Jonathan Rouse, thanks for being here today, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Two websites, and we have them at our homepage for Mr. Rouse's work, jonathanrouse.com. And learn more about what the Brookings Institution brings to your attention, brookings.edu. Well, I said some of the words some of the people are saying, but you say there is one word that best describes Donald Trump, and that word, sir, is?
Patrimonialism, a seven-syllable monstrosity.
With a significant historical foundation to it, after having read your article, that as someone who is going to read your article and that's listening right now is going to, you give people a Trump aha moment with your writing in this article.
Well, it was an aha moment for me. I picked it up from Jeffrey Kopstein and Steve Hansen, who wrote a book called The Assault on the State, and they're political scientists. But they noticed that this concept goes back 100 years to the great German sociologist Max Weber, and it was really the most common form of government until our system came along, and that's where the head of state essentially owns the entire state. The state is the personal property or family business of the person in charge.
And it's done in a means or a method or a style that adds legitimacy to what would more usually rationally be called a disruptive action, to say the least.
Yeah, well, you can actually layer this on top of an elected democracy, at least for a while, because it's not like this is where people go wrong, and you mentioned this in your intro. They think, you know, authoritarian or fascist. Well, those are very different because they're bureaucratic. You know, an authoritarian system will set up secret police and special military organizations and propaganda agencies and politburos. Patrimonialism is just a lot simpler. It says, look, from now on, everyone in the government is loyal to me. I own the government. What I say goes. And my friends will be rewarded and my enemies will be punished. And you don't need a new bureaucracy for that. In fact, you don't want a bureaucracy because bureaucrats are loyal to bureaucrats.
Does patrimonialism explain the MAGA movement and the adulation that Trump gets, where people outside of the movement are looking at those people are saying, are you blind? Are you not seeing this?
They're related. In fact, the term patrimonialism, what it comes from is Max Weber's observation that where a patrimonialist leader gets his, it's pretty much always men, gets his legitimacy is from being the symbolic father of the state. You know, I am the protector and the embodiment of the state. And, you know, of course, Trump said something very much like that when he said that he who's saving the state can break no law. So in that sense, yeah, what you want to do is set up your leader to be rightful because he's almost godlike. He's the symbolic father of us all. And that's, in other words, kind of a cult of personality.
When you look at Donald Trump, and one of the other things that people have said about him, he's not the brightest bulb, sharpest knife in the room. Did Trump create this, follow a lead? Did it just fall his way? Did he stumble upon it? What do you think is, how did he land into the spot through the way he landed in the spot?
Well, first of all, I think he's a very smart guy. So let's just get that out of the way.
All right.
But, you know, I would actually flip the question on you because patrimonialism is the default form of government. It's what down through history, most kings and emperors have done, and you see it outside of government in criminal organizations like the mafia. First scene of The Godfather is classic patrimonialism. You see it in street gangs, cults, all over the place. And so it's a natural state of affairs, and that's not what's unusual about Trump. What's unusual is that we had a system that got away from it, at least until January 20th. But he's from a background that he just naturally understands this world.
I pose the question as I did because, as you write in your Atlantic article, you name a couple of people connected to patrimonialism who, well, one of whom is Trump is openly enamored with, Hungary's Viktor Orban, and you also say that patrimonialism is very evident in Vladimir Putin's first term.
Yeah, in fact, he's the guy who kind of set off a global wave of patrimonialism. We're seeing it all over the place, and that was not true 20 years ago, but you see it in India now with Modi, in Turkey with Erdogan. It was in Poland for a while. It got knocked out of power. It's in Hungary at the moment. Saw it in the Philippines. You could go on and on. But the origin of this, the big guy who really put this back on the map was Vladimir Putin in the first 10 years or so, maybe 15 before the current war. Basically, the rule in Russia was you'd better be friends with Vladimir Putin. And if you're his friend, you'll be okay. And if you're not his friend, well, you'd better watch out. And then he set about making the world safe for patrimonialism, working to set up these kinds of regimes in other places, including his allies in Hungary and Belarus and so forth. And that's kind of what partly what set off this wave.
So with Jonathan Rauch, his recent article in The Atlantic, one word describes Trump. His recent book is Cross Purposes, Christianity's Broken Bargain with Democracy, JonathanRauch.com. He's also a senior fellow at Brookings Institution, Brookings.edu. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. You point out two things about patrimonialism that we have to understand in order to either regain control from it or defeat it before it becomes something more that we do not want. One of those is to understand it's not competent. It can't survive, can it?
Well, that's why it went away in the first place. It's to run a modern economy, a modern military, you need a lot of experts, you need a lot of formal processes, and you just can't do that if the leader gets up in the morning and says, you know, today I feel like raising the tariffs on Canada and cutting the tariffs on Mexico. So those regimes are always incompetent, and that always shows up. And in fact, that's why they ultimately lost out to the big, more bureaucratic, modern governments that we have. The other big shortcoming they have, of course, and the focus of my article, is they are always and invariably corrupt. And that's their real weak spot, because people do not like corruption.
But yet when we see the going after the Trump administration, going after MAGA, whatever you want to call it, why is that not the constant message? They seem to be, well, I mean, Trump in part, maybe through his wit or just his habit, he's setting off so many fires that they're playing whack-a-mole instead of focusing on how to combat patrimonialism.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's been the problem now for 8 years, is the tendency to chase whatever outrage comes up that day. And, of course, that's part of how MAGA distracts and disorganizes its opposition. You deliberately start all those fires every day. We know that Trump does this because he tells us. He'll start a fight on Twitter in order to distract people from something that's bad that's happened. So, yeah, you need to take offense. You need to put corruption front and center. It needs to become the daily message, a coherent, organized, disciplined campaign. You can't just respond to the patrimonialists. You've got to go after them, take offense, and focus like a laser on corruption.
Just to close out here, I do want to spend a couple of moments with your latest book, Cross Purposes, Christianity's Broken Bargain with Democracy, because as a Christian, to find wisdom coming from an atheist is not what I expected when I get up and get ready to read a book. But maybe it's the
you and me. It's not where I expected to be at this point in my life.
Maybe it's the outsider who gives the best, honest interpretation and understand. Because I think that you've done with Cross Purposes. I mean, this is something we've heard about. We've talked about Christians are among one another saying, I used to follow that pastor, but now they go up there and they'll throw a Bible verse out at the beginning, but then the rest of the sermon, they're doing social commentary. Or maybe who's a good example of Paula White, who fell into MAGA and went from being someone who could quote Bible verses off the top of her head in a teaching to being a total sycophant to politics. That's not what Christianity is supposed to be about.
Well, that's what Christians tell me, and my discovery from getting to know Christians and more about the Gospels is that the teachings of Jesus Christ are a whole lot closer to the teachings of James Madison than to MAGA. And so I'm just hoping my book will help encourage Christians to rediscover Christianity, because we need more of it right now, not less.
This is very true. For a Christian right now listening who is troubled, and we hear and we see the surveys and the reports, they're called the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, who just walked away from organized religion because of their disgust. What do you hope they're going to get from reading Cross Purposes that they can become proactive with in their faith?
Well, I'm addressing really two groups, and the nuns aren't one of them, but one is secular liberals like me who ignored, neglected, or even were sometimes hostile to Christianity, and we forgot that it's a load-bearing wall in our democracy. We still rely on our churches to do a lot of work in inculcating the values that the founders expected. And then my second audience is Christians, like, I guess, maybe you, Chris, people who are looking to bring Christianity back more to its core messages, which align very closely with the core message of liberal democracy, and not at all with cruelty and retribution.
You are indeed very insightful with that work, as you are with your Atlantic article and all of your writing. Again, the article is One Word Describes Trump. And the book, again, Cross Purposes, Christianity's Broken Bargain with Democracy, JonathanRauch.com. He's also a senior fellow at Brookings Institution, Brookings.edu, their website. Jonathan, it has been an education reading your work and talking with you, and also a pleasure. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.